Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
And welcome to Views of the News, the show that this week is going to tackle the issues surrounding doing journalism in real time. I'm your substitute host, Lee Wilkins, and with me in the Reynolds Journalism Institute studio, our regular panelist, Charles Davis, whose academic specialty is media law, and within that, public access to information. And guest panelist and journalism faculty colleague, Catherine Reed, a newspaper reporter and editor who spent some of her professional career in Europe. However, the focus of today's show is going to be entirely domestic. For the past several days, the nation has been tuned to the ongoing manhunt in Southern California, where former police officer Christopher Dorner's successful attempts to murder the family members and others resulting from his dismissal from the Los Angeles Police Department have resulted in a multiple-day ordeal. We're going to take a look at some of the ways that journalists covered this story, as well as the impact of some of the documents that Dorner himself posted on Facebook, in which he named specific journalists he thought were doing a good job. One of those, Chris Matthews, a cable television pundit, even praised Dorner's manifesto on the air. There's a great deal to chew over here, everything from the obvious but important question of whether CNN did the right thing in terms of finances or news to immediately switch to the Dorner standoff right after the State of the Union, as well as the deeper questions of how audience members regard those of us they see and hear on television, on radio, and in the newspapers on a daily basis. After discussing the California events, we'll turn to Washington, D.C. and the State of the Union, particularly emphasizing President Obama's speech as well as the reply by Republican GOP Florida Senator Marco Rubio, which he delivered in both English and Spanish. The links on our blog include the text and video coverage of the speech itself, but what we will focus on is how much of this constitutional requirement has become a made-for-television event, and whether what Charles calls a second-screen experience of fact-checking and blog commentary by media institutions such as the Washington Post and the New York Times actually helps audiences better understand the implications of what the president is saying. We'll then turn to the Vatican and the surprise resignation of Pope Benedict. We'll ask whether or not this story really did deserve the sort of breaking news emphasis it got, and also whether journalists did an appropriate thing of putting the resignation itself in context. Along with the good, there was also the ugly and the potentially funny. The New York Post, with a typical front page headline, Pope Gives God 2 weeks' notice, and Jon Stewart's satiric riff rounded out the media attention. We'll talk about whether this story was too serious to make fun of, whether journalists, including religion reporters, actually got to the crux of the issue, and whether in an increasingly secular world any of this matters as much as the headlines might suggest. We'll also ask Charles to update us briefly on a move yesterday in the Missouri legislature to make certain records more publicly available. And finally, to conclude, and to make Charles and me happy, this show will, briefly, go to the dogs, the ones who strutted their stuff at the Westminster Kennel Club last night. So, Charles, I want to begin with something that I know happens to both of us. People we really don't know, we hear our voices and begin conversations with, I listen to you on the radio. Christopher Dorner was actually clearly watching and listening, and his focus on media became a major thread in the manhunt story. So I want to begin by talking about, what do you think in our current environment is the relationship between journalists who used to be anonymous and an audience when we're not so anonymous anymore?
Well, it's certainly shrunken and shrunken in real time. And I guess the Dorner incident sort of underscores the fact that, I mean, we always do that, you know, your critics and your fans are out there watching the work that you do. And I've always felt like, at least within the confines of Columbia, Missouri, that's never been a very wide gap, because you're likely to run into people that you're writing and talking about on the street immediately after the show or when the Missourian goes to press. I actually think it's a really wonderful educational thing for our students, the fact that they do not live anonymously amongst us, and they can be called out for the coverage that they do. So I've always sort of been pretty comfortable with that. I know national media figures much less so.
Catherine, on the print side, at least when I was a newspaper reporter, I was very anonymous. So how has it changed, do you think, over the years?
Well, in just the last year, the Missourian started adding the supervising editor tags to every story. And the idea there was to create continuity in a newsroom where basically our entire staff turns over every semester. So it gives the community someone to contact. You know, the people know I'm the public safety editor and the healthcare editor, and so they can call me because that the reporter who did the story has, you know, moved on at that point. And so I'm comfortable with that. In fact, I'm happy about it because I get more calls and tips now from our readers about stories they think that we should be looking into.
Well, I've got to admit, and just a personal note, that I am frequently taken completely aback by somebody who recognizes my voice and talks to me as if we really do know each other fairly well, when I'm sort of standing there going, do I know your name? Do I have you out of context? How is it that we know each other? And then realize that in that instance, it was really all about hearing my voice on the show. So, I mean, I think there's sort of a range of responses. But, Catherine, I want to pick up on something you said. As the public safety editor, covering manhunts is hardly new territory, even in mid-Missouri. But I think sometimes it's difficult for the audience to understand the sorts of difficult journalistic decisions that are really being made, you know, sort of in real time. So as you look back over the events in California of the last 3 or 4 days, what are some of the things that you saw journalists sort of thinking about and then acting on, which may not actually have resulted in anything that the public could see?
Well, I think that from the very beginning, this story has posed very complicated questions, mostly related, not entirely, to social media. Once the manifesto appeared on Facebook, there was that initial, verification act that is so important. You know, is this the person? Is this Christopher Dorner? And after that, soon followed the violence that lasted another 5 or 6 days. Social media has created a layer of complexity in covering breaking news, both in verifying the information that's out there, you know, on Twitter and on Facebook, but also in the responsible use of social media. And so we saw the San Bernardino County Sheriff's Department and the DA ask for a Twitter stand down yesterday during the standoff with Dorner when he was in the cabin. And that has prompted a lot of discussion. It's the first time in Southern California that that's happened. But the specific nature of the request, that it was stand down on Twitter, some people were uncomfortable with the fact that it wasn't specific enough about, you know, why. The statement actually said law enforcement officers' lives could be imperiled. That seems pretty clear to me. But some of the critics of that request have said, you know, not specific enough. Well, when you consider that 2 police officers had already been killed and several injured, you know, for me, that would be enough. I think there may have been some umbrage taken at the fact that TV wasn't included in that. You know, why Twitter and not also television, which was also reporting live on the events, which were unfolding very, very quickly. It's very confusing. It's very difficult to cover breaking news. The public wants to know everything as soon as possible, but they hold us to a very high standard about what we report.
Charles, I know you're a former police reporter just like I am, and I know that this probably would not be the 100th time that the cops would have said, please don't report this right now, and for various reasons. So how do you sort of help our listeners and viewers think through what it is that journalists probably did well and didn't do quite so well?
Well, I mean, I think to go back to Catherine's point, you got to put it in the context of 2 police officers already dead. So this isn't some vague threat. and a plea by the police to stand down because they're trying to manage public relations. Clearly, the public relations disaster was already well underway. They had a renegade police officer who was killing people. So I think it wasn't some issue management thing where the press really had any right to feel that they were being used in some way by the cops here. And I think that's when we get sort of sideways with these requests to censor ourselves. And other, I mean, and there are a lot of people saying, you know, well, they ask us to, and I guess in a way they did ask the police reporters to censor at least themselves in one medium, but there is something instantaneous about that medium that is really conversational as opposed to mass communication. It wasn't like they were delivering news to an audience so much as they were. I guess what I'm seeing here is they were really worried about people communicating with him via the Twitter medium and him communicating back and it endangering people. And that's right. That's a context that the technology makes possible that really hasn't been possible before.
Although, I mean, I do recall instances of, you know, people holding other folks hostage where they said, well, I want to see my demands on TV. And even, you know, and the police as well as television or the police as well as newspapers, you know, having to decide, well, what of this do we broadcast? What do we not do? Do we do a special broadcast for that house only? You know, can go back as far as the Unabomber and the Washington Post decision about do we publish that manifesto because it might in some way aid both the Unabomber but also perhaps his capture. So, I mean, I think that we've sort of got antecedents to it, if you will, but I admit Twitter makes it much more complicated in part because, at least at the Twitter feeds that I looked at, some of those people weren't what I would call real journalists. In fact, I'm not exactly sure what they were. Catherine, how does that change things?
Oh, well, there was this whole trending topic on Twitter, which was we are all Chris Dornan. Chris Dornan had become a folk hero somehow. There were people who found in the manifesto something they identified with, something they believed, and partly that's because, I suppose, of the history of the LAPD. And so there was that whole thing was out there. And then you have always the problem, and it doesn't matter what the medium is, of people providing information that's just incorrect or inflammatory. And that's where the real challenge is for real journalists, which is sorting through that and trying to decide what could be really useful, what's actually true in a really fast-moving environment.
Well, Charles, I sort of have one additional question about this, and it happens that it converged on the night of the State of the Union when a lot of stuff was going on. So my question is, was this really a national news story? I mean, was CNN right to go immediately from the president back to the manhunt? Or was this something that we knew that the audience was going to tune in, so we did it for ratings, dare I say?
Yes and yes. I mean, it was a breaking news story and a huge breaking news story. And I think CNN made the right call. First of all, they got through the State of the Union before they left. Everything that happens after the State of the Union is spin, spin, spin. If I have a live news event that I know people are pretty riveted to, and I've got a bunch of politicos working around, I've always just hated that post-State of the Union spin fest being covered in any way. It gives more credence to that than it ever deserves, I think. So I had absolutely no problem with them going back to a breaking news event. That having been said, was that driven by ratings? You bet your sweet bippy it was. And I can't blame them one iota for making that decision. I thought it made a lot of sense.
Catherine, what about you? I see you nodding in agreement with Charles.
Well, yes. I mean, I can understand why people were riveted by the story. The manifesto was, it at least sounded like compelling information. Much of it, of course, will turn out to be absolutely untrue. I'm fairly confident. But so there was a lot that people identified with in it. And, you know, people love a chase. We know that. And, you know, we don't have to, we can go back much further than O.J. Simpson to find evidence that people love a chase. And so it has all these elements and that fine line between, you know, news and entertainment, you know, blurs more every day.
And you haven't lived till you go to the LA Times link that we put on the blog and read the comments. I mean, Catherine tried that hashtag, we are all
Chris Dornan.
Chris Dornan. Mm-hmm. They all came from the LA Times blog, I think, because if you go read the comments on there, my goodness, we've been watching too many Bourne conspiracy movies. I mean, it's really amazing what people will accept as fact.
Well, I've segued into the State of the Union a little bit, and Charles, you helped me a lot. But what I want to focus on is not the speech itself. There's been a lot of coverage of the speech and what it meant. But a couple of things that I thought were really different about coverage. The first one was real-time fact-checking, which I picked up on the Washington Post. Now, they may have done this before for other things, but it's the first time I can recall it on the State of the Union. And then the second was real-time blogging. So let's start here with a little clip of the State of the Union and then talk about those two wrinkles in coverage.
It is our unfinished task to restore the basic bargain that built this country. The idea that if you work hard and meet your responsibilities, you can get ahead. No matter where you come from, no matter what you look like or who you love, it is our unfinished task to make sure that this government works on behalf of the many. And not just the few, that it encourages free enterprise, rewards individual initiative, and opens the doors of opportunity to every child across this great nation. The American people don't expect government to solve every problem. They don't expect those of us in this chamber to agree on every issue. But they do expect us to put the nation's interests before party. They do expect us to forge reasonable compromise where we can. For they know that America moves forward only when we do so together, and that the responsibility of improving this union remains the task of us all.
So, Catherine, I got fascinated by the Washington Post and its real-time fact-checking. Why are we doing this? I mean, other than apparently now we can.
Well, I think it helps the public figure out real quickly what's spin. You know, as Charles was talking about the spin after the speech, we should note that there's a lot of spin during the speech. you know, just knowing what's true and what's not true, what's factual, what's not factual is of great value. We do more and more of this. We do it especially during election cycles when, you know, we became frustrated and the public became frustrated and disenchanted by basically competing voices, you know, who could shout the loudest. I was so happy when fact-checking popped up on the scene because I think it really is great public service journalism.
Charles, what about the real-time blogs? Did that help, detract? Well, I mean, you're the one who's always talking to us about the second screen experience. So what I want to know was this a good second screen experience?
Well, I was living it. So I had the laptop in my lap and the TV in front of me, and I was cruising, trying to look at different things. I was struck by CNN's real-time fact-checking. You mentioned the Post. One of our students in the Convergence program was live fact-checking for CNN, so I was kind of checking out his stuff. Interesting. And I think part of it, it's not just fact-checking. It's context adding. And that was really helpful. CNN several times on their blog that was sort of spot checking what Obama was saying was just extrapolating a bit. Like he picked the 6 million job number in terms of how many jobs have been added. And they went, yes, but, and they added some really important context there that if you're watching in real time, it really helps. I mean, it's almost like one of those shows where they kind of have the thought bubbles come up over the characters with little added factoids. You know, it just helps you understand a little bit deeper, a little bit richer what it is that you are engaging with.
So, Charles, I gather that you think that in this particular case, a lot of this, quote, additional second screen information actually added to the depth as opposed to detracting from it.
It's a double-edged sword. I mean, there's no question. If it's done well, it can really help. It is such a canvas for stupidity that if people do it poorly, it can really be. I mean, I did see some things last night that made me just go, oh, I mean, it's not the moment for analysis, for example. It's not the moment for punditry. And yet, they can't help themselves. So if you go look, and you know there were some pundits for CNN and MSNBC and probably Fox who were opining in real time, that's just a formula for bad commentary, really, because you've got to have time to think about. I mean, I find it as inane as the minute the speech ends, they turn to three pundits to go, now, instant analysis, what did that mean? That subtracts from the sum of human knowledge.
Catherine, one of the other things I noticed, and this has been true of State of the Unions for a long, long time, but even though the Constitution requires it and Washington didn't even give his first one in person, what we now have is a made-for-television event. We have people standing up and sitting mm-hmm. down. We have people in the gallery, Gabby Giffords among mm-hmm. others last night. Do you think that adds or detracts anything, or do people are now they're just looking at it, oh, it's a giant show, and I really don't have to pay much attention?
Well, I mean, it is political theater, and still, there are moments of real emotional power in it. The moment where the president talked about, you know, a vote on some gun control measure, and the people who were in the audience who lost loved ones in Newtown, Connecticut. I mean, you know, that's real. That was real pain on display there. And actually, probably one of the more valuable moments for the viewer, you know, to remember, because we forget so fast because we are exposed to so much news. It becomes thing of the day.
Okay, I'd like to move us very quickly onto the subject of religion or politics or religion. I'm still not sure what the story about the Pope actually represents. But first, I'd like to start with the way that at least it was presented to Americans is this was a breaking news story of the highest importance. And I really sort of wonder about that news judgment. Was this breaking news, or was this something that we would have been at least as well informed about if we'd given folks a while to think about it, analyze, provide the history, all of which sort of happened as follow-on? Charles, you want to take that one on?
First of all, I think it's as much a political story as a religious story. There's no question about that. This is a church that is a state. So I mean, it does stand alone in that regard. I think you also put up an interesting blog link that showed that the Pope is the most cited religious figure by a landslide in news coverage. So when the Pope does something, it's news and it's above the fold news more often than not. When for the first time in how many hundred years?
600 years,
a Pope resigns midstream. Massive news story. What I think I didn't see in that coverage, probably because it was so reactive, it was so episodic, was a lot of reasoned reflection as to what this may mean for the faith moving forward. There was a good Times piece that I think you linked on the blog. I read a couple of good think pieces online from other places that were sort of non-news outlets. But this is somewhere where and I know our colleague Deb Mason works very closely on a lot of this stuff, and I would commend people to the Religious News Media Center we run here, because I'm sure she says there's quite a gap between daily religious coverage and systemic religious coverage.
Well, Catherine, and then, of course, because we're Americans, we get the whole humor thing. And for some people, religion is truly one of those sort of verboten areas when it comes to humor. Not so for John Stewart. So let's take a really brief look at how Stewart handled the Pope's resignation.
But since you bring it up, what is the Pope's plan?
We'll do what he's been wanting to do for a long time, which is to read books and to pray.
Isn't that what the Pope was doing? Sounds to me like the only thing he's losing in retirement is the waving.
Catherine, inappropriate to be funny about this?
Oh, gosh, no. I mean, I think that, you know, there's long been irreverence about religion. And, it doesn't surprise me at all. I'm sure, though, that for some very devout Catholics, maybe this is a subject that should not be the subject of a, you know, clever John Stewart riff.
Well, I the clever John Stewart riff was one thing. I thought that the to-be-expected headline in the New York Post was quite something else. That was just about, well, that was what you would expect for the New York Post, right. But it was pretty much in your face. Charles, I mean, other than giving us what we always expect of them, did they go too far, or do we just throw up our hands and say, well, what do you expect from that source?
I mean, the Pope is a public figure, and one of the most public figures on the planet. With that comes license for parody and satire. And I think they get that. I mean, I'm not sure they've always appreciated that, but I think they get it now. The Vatican, by the way, has gotten very media savvy itself. I mean, if you look, I mean, the Pope's on Twitter now. So they're embracing all of the ways in which they communicate with their constituencies as well.
Okay, Charles, I want to ask you to just very quickly update us about the potential change to access to public records that's now, if I understand it, it's pending in the Missouri legislature, right? Past the Senate?
Yes, past the Senate out and is waiting on the House. And we'll see, because what happened was, as is typical in the legislative process, people tack stuff on. There was a very straightforward piece of legislation renewing some exemptions with regard to Homeland Security information and security information that were going to win very quick passage. They'd worked very closely with the Missouri Press Association on that language way back when, 2001, I think, in the wake of 9/11, to pass. It was non-controversial. Then yesterday, Senator Schaefer, our very own Senator Schaefer, tacked on, by the way, some really nice legislative language that would make it easier to punish offenders under the law. And then another member of the Senate tacked on some more language. So now it's become three times the bill that it was. So when that happens, you always watch as it leaves one chamber and goes to the other sort of with one eye closed, because you just don't know.
Well, Catherine, I know it's still pending. I know it's not really law yet, but since you do work a lot in public safety and there's a lot of public access issues involved, mm-hmm. Do you see that as potentially helping journalists or helping the public in any particular way?
Oh, the enforceability piece is really important, because I think that there are some public bodies that are very well aware that there is no enforcement unless you're willing to go to court. So I'm always happy to hear it's being strengthened.
Okay, well, for those of you who are accessing this show in a way that includes visuals, here's a very brief look at the winning dog, the best in show, at the Westminster Kennel Club last night.
Aww.
His name is Banana Joe, and I believe this is his 86th best in show, and he's not even an American. I think he goes home to retire in the Netherlands. So, Charles, you and I are dog crazed. If anything, okay.
Absolutely.
So, did anybody watch this?
Yes, and followed it on Facebook.
Yeah, I followed it on Facebook.
Oh, yes.
I watched it a little bit online. I didn't watch the entire event because it was conflicting with the State of the Union, and I had that sort of Faustian bargain going on there.
So, why do you think? I mean, even people who aren't dog lovers watch this thing. Why are we so mesmerized?
I think dogs are comical. I mean, I make sure I never miss the toy category. And I hope I won't offend listeners who have toys. I have a Border Collie, Australian Shepherd mix. I just think that they are just really fun to watch.
Charles?
As the owner of, I want to have two mutts and one purebred poodle, I can tell you that my dogs are the focus of much of my life. I think my family would probably attest to that too. And I'm, you know, millions of Americans are as obsessed as we are. Then you get the idea that it's just perfect social media theater. A dog show like that, where there are images, there are short video clips you can share, you can engage. Great second screen environment.
Well, we've run out of time. Mike McKean will be back in the host chair next week. Well, I will gleefully leave it to him to discuss media and technology, including the iWatch and cybersecurity. My thanks to my journalism colleagues, Catherine Reed and Charles Davis, for their insightful comments. We couldn't bring this show to you without significant help from our technical crew, including director Travis McMillan and audio director Pat Akers. We'd love to hear from you on our blog, and we've cached a lot of additional information about the stories we've discussed there on that site. So on this day before Valentine's Day, after you've hugged your pet, be sure to hug your sweetie. And this is Lee Wilkins encouraging you to do so. Thank you for listening. Good night for all of us at Views of the News.